This is the Doctor. President-elect of the High Council of Time Lords. Keeper of the legacy of Rassilon. Defender of the laws of time. Protector of Gallifrey.
I will not forget your line of this. Not one day.
Like many scientists, I'm afraid the Rani simply sees us as walking heaps of chemicals. There's no place for the soul in her scheme of things.
You are absolute idiots.
We are not idiots. We want to go home.
Yes, home.
I am Dr. Idiot.
Smith. Dr. John Smith.
Get off my world.
They're human beings, if that's what you mean, indulging their favorite pastime, trying to destroy each other.
Cancel the detonation.
Countermand it.
Cancel the detonation.
Countermand it.
I'm going to kill you in a minute.
Don't blink. Don't even blink. Blink and you're dead.
I say, what a wonderful butler. He's so violent.
Excellent. Absolutely exquisite.
Greetings, time travelers. Welcome to another installment of the Who's On podcast. This is number 40.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Heaven Sent. This is written by Stephen Moffat and directed by Rachel Talalay. And so that we get right into the setting and we see him teleport. We see him pick up sand. There's mm-hmm. sunlight. There's gears. There's stonework. It's a castle. We get that sense. There's blood, corridors. Hey, the doctor
and corridors. Who would have thought?
Stairs, the stairs, the spiraling staircase we see. So we basically, and the white noise TVs, basically the director is trying to set us up with what we're to expect here. Mm-hmm. We don't really know what to expect.
Mm-hmm.
The doctor steps out of the capsule and he starts to threaten whoever is listening.
If you think because she's dead I'm weak, then you understand very little. If you were any part of killing her, and you're not afraid, then you understand nothing at all. So for your own sake, understand this. I am the Doctor. I'm coming to find you, and I will never, ever stop.
And so right away, the Doctor is talking to whoever is listening. Now, Peter, what did you expect when he made that threat, when he stepped out of the capsule? Did you expect him to have, a regular episode? Mm-hmm. This was not a regular episode.
No.
It definitely wasn't. My first expectation is, as he was wandering around, and the more and more that he was finding empty rooms made me curious, because I was expecting him to track down, some kind of secret cabal. Coming right after the death of Clara, where he's got the little teleportation device, and he says, "You know what? Let me find out who sent you," because there was that whole thing. Ashilda was so worried about the power that was setting up this whole test to find the doctor to get him to finally teleport to them. I had no idea what to expect. We'd already done the vast intergalactic, interuniversal alliance of evil villains against Doctor Who with the Pandorica, so I knew it wasn't going to go that route. We've also done secret cabalistic society that was trying to get rid of the Doctor with the Silence, so I didn't think we would go that route. So I was thinking it was some madman who either had an issue with the Doctor, so maybe returned to an older villain. It's not going to be Missy, because we've already had her arc showing the love-hate relationship that they have. So I was expecting, someone that the Doctor had slighted. In a way, I was thinking we might go down the kind of a very hitchhiker to a guide to the galaxy aspect, where the rabbit that had been killed getting his revenge. And so this was some kind of revenge castle being built by someone who just wanted to torment the Doctor. And that's where I thought we were going with this. And as the story unfolded, I was very pleasantly surprised with how that worked. I saw sides to the Doctor that we hadn't really seen. And again, this is character growth, so I was very happy with seeing elements of that in there. But I'll let Rob give his retort before we go too down that rabbit trail.
Your take?
When it when the episode first started, when he steps out, I was like, oh, this is an interesting-looking TARDIS. That's like what my first thought was that he was in somebody else's ship.
Hmm.
I think when he starts talking the way he's talking about, like, if you're responsible for this, I started thinking about the Crow, and I started thinking about people that, as you said, Peter, would kind of have like a vendetta against the Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the first things I started thinking of was the Black Guardian. Relating to the Crow, and when you think of the costume that the Black Guardian wore was very like black feathers and stuff like that.
He had a raven on his head.
I was going to say, he even had, so... That was one of the things that I had thought of at first, but then I was like, no, but that doesn't really, like, we don't have the big story like we did previously when we saw the Black Guardian. You know, we don't, at least not in such a way.
Yeah, that arc kind of dribbled out, really.
That's what I mean. So it just kind of like, oh, okay.
Unless it's explaining the audio that I hadn't listened to yet.
Right. But, I mean, that was my first impression, really. Unfortunately, I had seen your wife say, like, oh, I thought of Mist and, like, all, like, the rotating tower. And I was like, and I, before I saw the episode, I read that. And so my mind was already a little bit twisted towards that idea of, like, watching for, like, Mist clues. Yeah, which it didn't take very long to get to that.
Mm-hmm.
Also very early on, I think it was actually even before the episode begins, is that little monologue about, you know, there's something in the shadows just creeping, slowly trying to catch up to you. So it didn't really directly relate to Mist and the idea of, like you said, solitude, but it did remind me of other things pretty early on, which, I don't know, I'll just say it reminded me of Silent Hill 2 and some of the characters, the way that game plays out with the solitude and the mystery and the puzzles and, you know, trying to figure things out. It's just very much that whole kind of mind trip thing.
Mm-hmm.
Neat. Yeah, I thought it was going to be like a regular episode, Step Out, Doctor Challenge. And I was thinking more along the lines of Mummy on the Orient Express. We've never actually figured out who that was, who set that up.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I've never thought about the Black Guardian, but that would have been interesting.
Hey, it still might be, because we still don't know who hired Ashilda.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because to jump ahead to the next episode, she still has the tattoos.
Or even the toy maker.
Even that, maybe.
Hmm.
It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a long time. And I wasn't ruling out Missy either, because she did know about the confession dial.
Mm-hmm.
See,
and we haven't seen her since the first episode, second episode.
I didn't necessarily connect this to the confession dial until a little bit later on. Right. It took a while for it to finally, once the Doctor spoke truth, well, and I think we're now entering into the plot line.
Yeah, yeah.
So as the Doctor is exploring the castle now, he suddenly has this shadowy thing following him. And I didn't see the little teaser before when I turned on the television. The episode
came in
just started.
So you missed the little monologue at the beginning.
I saw it from when he flashes in.
Okay.
So I saw from the very start of the episode, but I didn't see the few seconds
that
teaser
intro
that they
thing.
Do. And so I just was watching straight across and like, oh, okay, this kind of empty place. Is he just in his a prison of his own design? Was where I started going after a while. And then you had that veiled creature starting to chase him. And that was when I started realizing, and he spoke truth, and the thing paused. And that's when I connected it to the confession dial. Because now, oh, all right,
yeah,
this is all about him speaking truth. It's somebody has set up this as a way to finally get him to admit something. Mm-hmm. What are they looking for him to admit finally? And then once it started being about the hybrid, then I started wondering, well, maybe this is someone trying to extract information about that. And then I started thinking that it could be either the Time Lords or another organization, maybe the Daleks, trying to force the Doctor to talk about stuff that he doesn't want to talk about.
Now, I just realized, too, I just thought about it, that maybe at the beginning of the season, when the Doctor was walking around the dial, that there was nothing in it yet.
Mm-hmm.
Because it took him to go through what he went through in this episode to make the confession,
mm-hmm.
for it to be on the dial. So maybe that's the whole point, is that he didn't actually teleport in, but whatever the button was, maybe it was even the Time Lords that gave a shield to the contraption that caused him to press the button, mm-hmm. which in a sense triggered the confession dial to record his confession.
Yeah.
And that this whole machine of this process is how the dial works.
Although the inference was made in the first episode when Missy had the confession dial that this was because he was her close friend and they've known each other for so long,
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
she would have right. the right to this mm-hmm. object.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that she knows whether or not it's already been used.
True.
You know, maybe he was just kind of playing around with it as if it was already on it.
Because
mm-hmm. at the same time, too, when he completely ignored the confession dial with Davros, maybe it's because he knew it was blank. So yeah. he's like, mm-hmm. oh, okay, well, whatever. You have that, and there's nothing in it yet.
Good point.
Because nobody knows what a confession dial is except for the Time Lords.
Exactly.
And even then, I don't think the confession dial comes and actually has anything in it until you step into it.
Right.
We started kibitzing a little bit about what all this is. For me, the thought occurred the confession dial had nothing until he steps in, and then it reads him, not yep. just his conscious self, but also that mm-hmm. subconscious self. That's how it knew to draw from this fear that he had, this primal child fear of the dead Time Lord, or Time Lady, really,
yeah.
Who is just shrouded in veils. And that idea of mortality and everything else terrified mm-hmm. the young boy who would become the Doctor to such a degree. So that first initial reading creates a multiple series of scenarios that's going to force you to admit one way or the other. And it starts becoming a very interesting psychological analysis to the Time Lords that this is what they invent, that they are so terrified of actually telling the truth and communicating.
Yeah, that they have to go and develop this process for getting that truth from somebody.
They would make bad Catholics.
They would make very bad anything. And I think that that's one of the main elements of who they are and why the galaxy fears them so much, that the Daleks create this time war in fighting them. But it's kind of a horrific race, that they are so deceitful to themselves. They don't even admit truth to themselves. Because I think this invention, not that somebody else had created this mist-like castle, but that's the Doctor's own subconscious. And we've seen that before. When Amy and Rory and the Doctor were freezing or boiling to death in that whole Dream Lord creation. And you get the sense that the Dream Lord is the Doctor. He hates himself so much that he created that whole scenario. And so this is...
It has that episode has the very Mummy on the Orient Express Gus kind of... vibe to it, too.
Mm-hmm. So much of this self-loathing and self-deceit,
mm-hmm. the same kind of thing.
They can't communicate. And now suddenly that starts making sense. In the last episode we had recorded, I'd complained that if the Doctor had just paused for a moment and explained to Clara what the whole quantum shade thing was and the tattoo and... Don't take the tattoo on yourself, or you know, just describe how when you place it on there, then you have to have it removed or suffer the consequence, kind of a thing. If he had taken the few seconds to sit down and say, "Here's how the universe works," or in this particular scenario, and here's the different details, and then sent her on her way, we would never have had Clara's death.
But that's an inside joke. He always says, "I'll explain later."
Yeah.
But he never explains.
Mm-hmm. But again, it's the Doctor being the Doctor. So this is, again, truth and consequences, where the consequences of the Doctor being the Doctor are Clara's going to die. the consequences of the Doctor having a truth dial is he's going to have to admit the truth, even if it's only admitting to himself.
Yeah, because who's reading that truth? Who's reading the confession dial? If he the story goes on basically saying that if he was just to confess,
mm-hmm.
he would have been let out.
Mm-hmm.
It would have opened up to him. But he didn't want to confess, so he went the long way around.
Yep.
So who is he confessing to? Is he confessing to Rassilon? Is he confessing to the rest of the Time Lords, the High mm-hmm. Council? Or is he confessing just to himself in the shade, this veil?
Yeah. I get the feeling that subsequent people would be able to then access the confession dial, because it would basically be a last... We call them last wills and testament. And a testament is a contract. But a testimony is a discussion. A brief overview of some point. And I think if you had been able to hit the big red button or whatever, the little audio recording of all of the confessions that would be spoken in the confession dial are now available. It's a recording device. Mm. That's how I walked away from this episode thinking.
It's interesting that you mentioned that. They did use something like that in Genesis of the Daleks, too, where Davros listened to everything that Tom Baker had to say about every part of the failing of the Daleks so that mm-hmm. he could then program the Daleks better.
Yeah.
How did we lose? Why did we lose?
Mm-hmm.
In what battle did we lose? Mm-hmm. And then one of the main things of that episode was getting back the tape.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The other thing, too, that was mentioned, which I didn't even think about, but you said the big red button, and all of a sudden I thought of the friendly red button.
Right.
And mm-hmm. How that episode was another kind of like bootstrap looping around on itself. And how just it would have been interesting to go back and review that one again, too, and to see how they played with the with the bootstrap in there.
Right away, he gets to a room with Clara. The painting is there, and the paint is flecking off.
Mm-hmm.
And you know immediately that it has to be very old.
Mm-hmm.
And then he mentions the age of it. Now, I guess, carried on.
It can't be very old because it resets every time.
Well, we haven't even gotten to that
yet. Well, see, there, that would show age. That would be... Well, the painting, I would think, wouldn't last 7,000 years.
It depends on the atmosphere. But at the same time...
It's salty atmosphere?
I was going to say, well, we don't know it's salt. It could be fresh water.
Well, he said
salt.
He does say salt water.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
that I don't know that paint would hold up like that.
No.
At least not that it would flake off like that. It certainly wouldn't have dried out to that. Look,
also depends on what type of paint and style that it really is. We're looking at it. It looks like a modern day oil painting,
mm-hmm.
But who knows what substance it's made out of? Who painted it? How you know? So.
Yeah. And it's interesting too because it's the only time you see Clara's face, other than the whole Amy Pond stroking thing at the last part where she puts her hand up to his cheek. The visions of Clara are all her back turned,
mm-hmm.
and that's the last, and the same hairstyle is the last thing the Doctor sees when the Raven takes her. And so it's just neat that in the painting you actually see her face, where in everything else, and the chalkboard, you know, chalk from the last season was very important. He was always writing with chalk.
Mm-hmm.
So she's at the chalkboard. At first I thought it was a canvas because it looked like it had been brushed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But she writes. And she's what we had said in previous episodes. She's his Jiminy Cricket.
Yep.
She's the conscience.
Mm-hmm.
What would she do? What would she say? What will Clara think? And the Doctor gauges his next movements
based on what information he's kind of fed by her.
By her, yeah. It's a very important piece of the next story
mm-hmm.
when it comes to the hybrid. But... Continuing on, I know there was a lot of moments of suspension of disbelief where the story, Moffat's brilliant in the way that he can piecemeal these little tiny things and mm-hmm. then put them all together at the end where you see it, where you hadn't seen it quite like that before. Mm-hmm. Now, some of the things I figured before it was revealed, but some of the ones I did not. The skulls I had figured were the Doctor's skulls. Now the fact that the skulls over 4.5 billion years, or however long it was, I think it was 4.5, they wouldn't rise above the castle, to me was interesting. But you had mentioned...
How deep is that lake or body of water?
Well, he gets to the bottom of it where there are skulls and there's not too much water above.
The bottom... Yeah, well, all right. That's also, he's at the 7,000-year mark.
So I know there's a lot of things in the story that the people on the internet are kind of questioning. And if you want to look at some of the ones, there's the continuity discussion going on TARDIS Data Core or TARDIS Wiki, if you want to look some of that up. But you had mentioned some of them personally, Rob, that you had a problem with during watching it. Please let the audience know.
The biggest thing for me was probably, I'd say, just the whole reset thing. Because as I was saying before we started recording, they almost, like, I could almost justify the way that the story's happening. But then other things happened that make me not able to justify the explanation I just tried to grant them.
Yeah.
For instance, as we were just talking about the skulls, so I'll bring that up. If there are a pile of skulls, which are all the Doctor's skulls, that means that the water didn't reset. Because they pile up. But again, as we also just made the point, that if skulls have been piling up like that for 7,000 years, then 4.5 billion years, there should have been a lot more skulls by the end of it.
Yes and no. The skulls will decay.
Well, that's true, too, at the bottom, dirt. Because of the weight. They'll kind of do a whole...
Not just that, but skulls don't last that long. As a paleontologist, I love skulls because, hey, only one out of every... 1,000 fossils is a skull.
Okay, take that a step further. Now, if the skulls disintegrated and became dirt and dust, wouldn't that increase the level of dirt? Whereas the Doctor jumps out of the window, and now he's jumping into dirt and not actual water.
Yes and no, because when you look at geology, you do have compression. There's a large discussion in certain geological circles of how much the silt that something like the Mississippi River is actually depressing and deforming the superstructure that makes up the crustal plate in which the Gulf of Mexico is sitting upon. Some of the sound readings that we've done geologically give us an indicator that some areas, because of the weight of the silt that's being deposited there, are actually pressing down and then forcing part of the plate into a hotter spot of the mantle where it melts and you now have more geological activity. So it's possible that after 4.5 billion years, the pile of skulls is not really going to be that much more different in size if this is a planet. We don't really know how extensive this whole confession dial reality is, what exactly it is. So there's a bunch of questions on what will eventually happen to the debris that these skulls are generating. It itself might just have a point in which once you've hit X, it ceases to register it and just sweeps it away and recycles it. And that starts making me look at some of the other issues that we've discussed about this, like, for example, the Doctor, as he's starting to dig what we presume to be his grave, and then finds at the very bottom the plate saying, I'm in room 12, or whatever the words exactly were. Why didn't that reset? And then part of that, in me, starts thinking maybe it wasn't necessarily something that needed to be reset, but rather something that, again, if this confession dial is reading the Doctor's subconscious as part of his need for there to be a back door, he creates this whole long route scenario where easy route, I finally confess and give in to what people want and admit to myself stuff that I don't want to talk about versus taking the silent road, however long that will take me. But I will give myself the silent road option because I always have to have a back door. So when he makes the first step in there, subconsciously has created this entire reality in which you've got the veil monster, you've got the back door option of the clues that I leave behind for myself without knowing that I've left them behind for myself, leading me to the 20-foot-thick wall of harder-than-diamond substance that If I punch, I will only get rid of a few molecules at a time, but after a few billion years, I'll finally break through.
Man.
I think that's the best explanation that anyone can come up with.
It might actually be the real one. Stephen Moffat, if you're listening, please tell us.
Yeah. If it's not, Stephen Moffat will say, yeah, that's it.
Probably. But yeah, I mean, because that's where, like I said, I guess part of it, too, again, is just like you said, we don't know how much reality is involved here. But the fact that there were so many things that did reset every time the Doctor would have to teleport back in, but the fact that they changed whether or not certain things reset.
Why did his clothes not reset?
Well, yeah. I mean, more specifically, the clothes, they showed that the clothes reset. They showed that he had the clean clothes, that he reset the clothes himself. Right, he had the dry clothes that were there because he had set up.
The first time, don't know how they got there unless he walked around naked during his first. I'll leave these here for the next me.
But that's the same thing as the next me. Right, but that's the same thing as I'm in room 12. Mm-hmm. Is that never would, like? I mean, but then again, they also never show him write it. So there's skipping the step where he creates that pattern, whereas with the clothes, they show that step.
Where that would be a bootstrap.
Right, but that's the point, is that there would have to be a bootstrap, but they never show it repeat. They never show the loop.
Yeah.
Why, like I said, like with the, you know, a lot of the time they'll have the loop back, as I like to call it.
Yeah.
But the blood thing, when he first shows up, there's a trail of blood, which we later find out was from him dragging himself up to the teleporting machine. But then at the end of the episode, or halfway through, they show the blood wipes itself. So they broke that specific part. Not just that it doesn't work in line with what's going on, but the fact that it doesn't work in line with itself, that they changed the way it functioned.
See, I wasn't too concerned about the blood. That one I was willing to understand because he died. And whenever he either gave a confession or I'd say died, then it would reset.
But it was. But my point is, when he first teleported in, the blood was there. So it never got reset. And he'd already been there for 7,000 years.
Bird was there as well.
My point is that at the end, later on, they show the blood not be there at a reset. So they're saying that somehow, during the course of the 7,000 to 4.5 billion years, the blood started cleaning itself instead of not cleaning itself for the first 7,000 years that he was there.
Or it's intermittent in what it... Because we don't know anything about the 7,000 years prior. Maybe this was the first time that the blood didn't reset. But then why is this a unique situation?
Right. But the problem you have with that then is the butterfly effect.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, and I had the same kind of thing about the shovel. Was that, to back up a little bit, when I first started watching the episode and he walks over and he picks up the shovel with the dirt, I was like, oh, this is going to be another loopback episode. Like somehow right away with that, I knew that this was, it was going to be a situation where he's finding the pieces and he's going to end up having to lay those pieces out for himself again later on. Maybe it's because I played too many games and watched other things that do this.
But... Was it the same shovel?
Yeah, because
the shovel didn't have dirt on it.
He finds the shovel. See, and that's another problem with a loopback. That's another problem that I find a flaw with it, which is why I don't believe that it can happen in reality. Because there would have to be two of the shovel. Because there has to be the one upstairs that's dirty when he finds it, and there has to be one downstairs that's clean when he finds that. But it's supposed to be the same shovel. Twice. So the same shovel exists twice in that reality, unless it's that different rooms and different parts of the castle reset at different times, depending on where he is. But again, that's outside of it. We have to suspend disbelief on that.
Yeah. Okay, let me ask a question. Every time he gives a confession, the castle rotates and resets, basically.
But the castle's rotating all the time.
It's rotating constantly? Because we only see it after he confesses where the castle starts to change. It doesn't reset, I should say. I should amend that. Where it starts to rotate. Now, are the rooms in different places? Is this why he has to be at 12 during that time? Because he doesn't want it to rotate and change where the location is? Is that why he doesn't take the shovel and beat it and just uses his fist?
Yeah, there are a whole bunch of different things. Like, a shovel is much stronger than the human hand. So I would have brought the shovel in.
I mean, he makes a swath. A path body-sized with his fist,
well,
whereas it would just, he would have to be like, there'd have to be like A billion years of him laying on the ground punching,
well,
too.
Yeah. Think about how much time he wasted by carving out that whole body-sized hole.
Yeah.
Whereas if he had just punched himself through something small enough to crawl through, he might have been able to do it in one-third of the time.
Yeah.
So he spent 4.5 billion years punching this hole.
And he spent a lot of time talking while he was punching rather than just punching and making his shortening his time that he would have to do this.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which, by the way, being the great geek that I was, I figured out he is striking the surface and creating an indentation 4 microns in size.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
About the size of a bacterium.
So did you do the mathematics on this? Is this 4.5 billion years to go through 20 feet of asbantium?
Yes.
Okay, very good.
Based off of the few factors that I tried to figure out,
that's pretty cool.
I'm getting 4 microns.
Wow. So... I don't know.
This is deaf?
The...
Huh?
Deaf? Definitely.
That's the number that my calculator resulted in when I factored it in.
So this is totally legit.
Yes.
Right. So now this is another point, though, by the way. We meant about the butterfly effect,
mm-hmm.
right? So if it's a confession...
Don't include me in that.
It's a confession that, well, you'll be brought into this.
Okay.
That if the whole point of the dial is to get him to confess things...
Mm-hmm.
It's going to change the way that it reacts when he does. Because there must have been a time where he didn't confess the first time that he confessed, right? When he first opened the doors. Think about this. Think about this.
He doesn't confess
if
the first
whole
time
point, if the whole point of this thing right. is to get him to confess, then the first time he was there. See, and this is again, it's why I don't mm-hmm. believe in a bootstrap, because it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Because if it's there
well, that's
for
why it's
him
a bootstrap.
If it's there for him to confess, then when he makes the confession, it changes. So the next time it loops around, it is different.
Well, but I think what it's looking for is maximum number of confession.
Yeah, but what if
but
why,
it's different then.
Why is
but
he
the next time he does it, it'll be different. Because you think about it. If the first time he was there, he says, oh, what is this veil thing coming at me? And he never confesses, never stops it the first time, then he never goes and carries out the whole rest of the process.
Yeah.
If the veil kills him before he gets to go through and dig up the hole and do all this, none of the rest of it happens. The skull never falls from the roof and never ends up in the water.
Mm-hmm.
So then at some point, he had to realize that he needed to confess so that he causes everything else to take place. Maybe some other time, maybe he didn't pick up the shovel and he didn't dig the hole, and so the veil mm-hmm. got to him through the door or through the window, and he died then.
Yeah, but then he wouldn't have been able to reset himself.
That's my point.
Unless...
That's why I don't think the bootstrap works. Unless, of course...
We have, again, and this is going back to predestination, each one of those scenarios must always be based off of his internal workings.
But at the same time with that, is that... I don't know. Well, then why did he program the long way around? Is where it gets just like stupid. Is that
my
it's
problem.
Just like when you think about it, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
The more I'm thinking about it, the more I'm disliking the episode. So maybe we should just stop now.
Oh, Rob. My problem is that for 4.5 billion years, is he confessing the same thing?
Yes. I was wondering about that too.
Because
like, is he
the
making the same state
or the veil know, hey, you already confessed this 20,000 times.
That's my point though. That's what I'm saying. Is that if
I'm gonna kill you now. Because you already confessed that. You got to confess something different, dude.
But that's what I mean, is that if the veil stopped... See, and that's a good point right there, mm-hmm. is that 7,000 years, supposedly, he's already done this. Yet, here he is on the second time around. He can't confess the same thing.
Okay,
so
or
how
is the
it...
veil resetting, too?
Well, then it wouldn't reset every time. That's the problem.
Why not?
Because they show that the... Well, the veil can't reset every time, because mm-hmm. then he would. Then it breaks the second time he goes in. Unless it resets every other time, which doesn't work. Because
why can't the veil reset if the room resets?
Because if the veil resets, let's see, because it's in there. I know it's in there. Because if it changes, it doesn't work. I just have to figure out how to place it together. Because the fact is that if the veil resets, where would it reset? First off, that's the point that you have to figure out, is if there's a reset and a loop back. No, I'm serious. This is me going insane,
yeah.
but this is a point, though. If it's a loop back and you accept
that
it's
that
a loop
process.
Back, you have to find where the reset is. It's the same thing as what I've done with Back to the Future time and time mm-hmm. again, too, is that you have to find if the veil resets, which allows him to confess the first time but then not repeat that confession, you have to figure out where the veil resets itself. Does it reset itself after the second confession where he tries to tell it the same thing? And then so then when he comes back around again, it's offset, so he can reconfess the first thing again.
There's a possibility that, and you were kind of talking about how this is so connected with the video game Silent Hill, which I admit I never really delved into before. But if this is drawing from his primal fear in order to force him to confess, mm-hmm. and it's designed to do that, mm-hmm. then it's not designed necessarily to kill him until he's ready for it to kill him in order to start the process over again.
Well, there is that point as well.
So he will never get painted into the corner until
he's ready to.
There's
as the bird. Yeah. As when he's telling the bird story. Right.
So you get this possibility that in the first 7,000 years, he always managed to slip out because he wasn't quite painted into the corner just quite yet. There mm-hmm. was still that option in order to set up the whole scenario. What we're seeing is not necessarily the exact same scenario repeated ad infinitum, mm-hmm. but rather elements of the story that, all right, point A, point B, point C
right.
are those predetermined, must happen, mm-hmm. Fixed points.
Right.
And therefore, everything in between those elements are somewhat fluid and loosey-goosey that can be twisted around.
Timey-wimey.
Yeah.
Okay. Like he says, he draws the veil to one side of the castle and then runs mm-hmm. to the other side of the castle.
And
interestingly enough, he said 82 paces in the last episode, faced the raven looking for the street, trap street.
Mm-hmm.
This time it's 82 minutes to find room 12
mm.
that he has to spare between sleeping, eating, mm-hmm. and finding room 12.
While we are on numbers, one thing that I did want to bring up, which is completely separate from the episode itself, but more for our episode. This is episode number 40 that we are recording. 40 in mythology is the time of testing. So the ultimate Doctor Who test is our 40th episode.
Hmm.
Spooky.
Very spooky.
I'm going to play you an audio, the Doctor explaining.
No! Of course I had to jump. The first rule of being interrogated is that you are the only irreplaceable person in the torture chamber. The room is yours, so work it. If they're going to threaten you with death, show them who's boss. Die faster. And you've seen me do that more often than most. Is that right, Clara? Rule one of dying, don't.
Mm.
Two, slow down. If for the rest of your life, the faster you think, the slower it will pass. Concentrate. Assume you're going to survive. Always assume that. Imagine you've already survived. There's a storeroom in your mind. Lock the door and think. This is my storeroom. I always imagine that I'm back in my TARDIS, showing off, telling you how I escape, making you laugh. That's what I'm doing right now. I am falling. Clara, I'm dying. And I'm going to explain to you how I survived.
I like the fact that he goes into the TARDIS whenever he needs to think something through in a split second, but everything slows down for him.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a neat little ploy they used in it. And then Clara playing the part of Jiminy Cricket, of course, here. How are you going to win? That is always her question this season.
Mm.
When it comes from the first Ashila episode, when it comes to Missy asking how the Doctor survives at the Daleks. So I'm enjoying the fact that Moffat's like tying all these things together with the hybrid and just these common themes that this whole season, it's not necessarily an arc because it's done so different compared mm-hmm. to other Doctor Who seasons.
Right.
And that's what I think makes it more like a classic Doctor Who year.
Mm-hmm. Well, because it's more about the concepts, not so much the stories. Like you said, it's more dealing with the philosophy behind what's mm-hmm. happening than the characters within it.
And which makes it more timeless to me.
Yeah, mm-hmm. definitely.
Which it's going to stand the test of time a lot better than some of the
mm-hmm.
previous.
Mm-hmm.
The only issue I take with that last monologue the Doctor had talking about it is that he says that he's always bouncing the ideas off of her.
Mm.
So what happened for the 9,000 years that you lived before this, though? I mean, I know that this is just scripting and this is just the way they wrote it for this, but, you know, don't make it seem like the Doctor never did this until he met Clara and he only started doing this slow down time to figure out things.
That's the point of the next episode, too, is that these two, Clara and the Doctor together, are the perfect match. That's what Missy put them together for, to bring down the fall of the High Council and to bring down Rassilon. To make, because they took him at the end of the End of Time episodes, and they tortured him. Mm-hmm. She's back now, but that master was oppressed by by the Time Lords, and from the time he was a child, they drove him crazy.
Yep. Yeah.
And this is Missy's comeuppance, using the Doctor, using her friend, her cousin, maybe. To avenge her in that way, and bringing the woman at the shop, the Clara and the Doctor together, time and time again.
Yeah, it is a very interesting thing, which maybe Missy had an element to tweaking the confession dial to create something along these lines. Maybe that's where certain things don't necessarily reset. So. Stephen Moffat, we're giving you a second option.
Maybe that's why the confession dial didn't go to Clara. Maybe it went to Missy because
she had a control over it.
Right. Mm-hmm. There's a foreknowledge there that she would have.
Maybe she even helped set up the long way around. Maybe that's the whole point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe it was as much of a.
I would think she would make it a little easier than that, though.
I don't know.
I think she knows. She knows that the Doctor likes to think things through and figure them out.
And she is still going to be a little cruel and sadistic. So if it takes him 4.5 billion years, well, okay, so be it. She has all of the time in the universe to wait for her her revenge to be fulfilled.
And I love the little angle about the Brothers Grimm and the Shepherd Boys story.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Shepherd Boys asked by the Emperor how many seconds in eternity. And to this he replies, there's a mountain of pure diamond. It takes an hour to climb it and an hour to go around it. Every 100 years, a little bird comes and sharpens its beak on the Diamond Mountain. And when the entire mountain is chiseled away, the first second of eternity will have passed. The Doctor thinks that's one hell of a bird.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why he writes bird.
That's why bird, because he is the bird.
Chisel at that asbantium.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, asbantium wall, which is supposedly 400 times the strength of diamond.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So on a larger scale, just going back to this whole thing of the hybrid and them being the perfect pair.
Okay.
I don't like that idea.
I agree with you.
Because I don't like the idea of them saying, well, after all of the adventure that's happened, Clara is your perfect companion, yet we just killed her. Mm-hmm. And now she's not going to be in the show anymore.
But she's not.
Well.
That's where Hellbent gets in, where that's the point of the hybrid.
But that's where, I'm frustrated with that idea because that would lead me to say, well, then the show is either going to have to wind down, and like Doctor Who is going to need to end, because if he's now found his perfect companion and he can travel through time and space and find the answer to every situation he's in all the time, there's no mystery. We're never going to watch an episode again and be like, oh, can he get out of it? Because we're going to be like, oh, the Doctor and Clara are together, they'll get out of it.
Well, that's sort of like, the way that the reason why they broke up the Tom Baker, Romana and Tom Baker and K-9
trio. Because they could always figure out.
Yeah, they were indestructible.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they made the next Doctor, Peter Davison, more vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they gave him, except for Nyssa, some real
tools,
duffers of companions.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I mean, Tom Baker did have Adric later on, but... and Nyssa and Tegan as well. But they broke up the Romana K-9 trio.
Right. The
because they were indestructible.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It's just... I don't know. I mean, as it's... We'll get into it with the next episode that we do. But the way that it's all laid up now, it's very... I don't even... I mean, I guess at the same time, they did break it up because they had the whole thing where the Dr. White gets his memory wiped. But that's... We'll save that for next time.
True. He knows that these adventures happened, he just doesn't know who with.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There is also one other possibility that even though it's Clara, her face is not something that he sees in this episode. And so she is more a concept than necessarily a reality.
Mm-hmm.
It's his perception of... So even without necessarily having Clara as the companion, any companion can still fulfill that role because it's the Doctor showing off.
Mm.
Yes, he wants to have the perfect mate to show off to, someone who can truly appreciate everything that he's doing.
Right.
But to me, that's why they left Clara's back to him,
yeah.
So that he's not 100% sure who he's really talking to.
Mm-hmm.
It still can be the everyman.
See, and at the same time, that whole statement of the idea of him having a companion he can show off to is that that's what he did with Romana.
Mm-hmm.
Because she was a time lady. So he could say, like, oh, look at this. See, I'm a genius time lord. See, this is what
we
do.
Yeah, but she always put him down.
And did things better than him. Yeah, she would always knock on him. But I think he always kind of appreciated that at the same time, though. Because I think he always respected the fact that, you know, especially with...
Mary Tam or Lala Ward?
I was going to say Mary Tam. Especially with Mary Tam, I think he always kind of had that almost boyish crush admiration for her. That's the way it always kind of seemed to me, was that he always respected her more than just a companion, but almost as if she was a love interest, but not someone that he would actually be willing to go after.
She was right out of the academy at the time.
Right.
And...
yeah, because she was much more by the books than he ever was.
She was. She wanted to know where the Type 40 manual was.
Mm-hmm.
And she was very by the books. And she proved to him with a nice safe landing, a nice smooth landing, what the TARDIS could really be.
Yeah.
as Romana was there more and more, Romana became more and more like the Doctor, where mm-hmm. she even started to dress like him.
Mm-hmm.
With the
as
pink,
with Lala
the
Ward,
pink,
we see later on that she's got
the
weird...
pink, the pink cloak and mm-hmm. or coat with the long white scarf and... And so we've seen that a little bit happen with Clara, where she's more and more like him, not necessarily in clothing style, but definitely in attitude. And
mm-hmm.
She is the mirror, the female mirror of the Doctor in a lot of ways.
Mm.
And that's why it's interesting at the end, when she's actually printing on the chalkboard, he asks her, what should I do? And then Clara uses the chalk, same as you. And the Doctor replies, but let's be honest, it's what killed you.
Mm-hmm.
And the Doctor picks up the shovel and digs.
Mm-hmm.
So he knows that the reason that Clara is dead is because she was too much like him.
Mm-hmm.
Part of this whole episode is how he's dealing with his grief of mm-hmm. losing her, especially since she was so like him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where one thing was to make that illusion of Romana. Romana went off to help rebuild something. She chose to leave,
right.
And the writers, of course, wrote her out. And then she later became Lord President, and Leela became her right hand person,
mm-hmm.
and her guardian. But anyway, Clara wasn't given that opportunity. Clara's cleverness was hoisted on her own petard, really.
Mm-hmm.
She thought that she could get out of anything.
Mm-hmm.
Don't let the Doctor know about my little plan because he's going to react this way, in which a shield is going to react that way to him. She had it all figured out.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And she usually got it right.
Yeah.
But in the Doctor's world, it's high stakes, and
mm-hmm.
she rolled wrong.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
The Doctor confesses about Gallifrey. I have two clips to play for this. One is from Patrick Troughton, the lie. Which, at the time, it's at the end of the War Games, and he's talking to Jamie and Zoe.
I'm pretty sure it's Zoe.
And the other is the Doctor confessing to the veil or the shade.
There are truths that I can never tell.
Love the TARDIS talking.
Not for anything. But I'm scared, and I'm alone. Alone. I'm very, very scared. I confess.
I didn't leave Gallifrey because I was bored. That was a lie. It's always been a lie.
Not enough. You want more?
I was scared. I ran because I was scared.
Is that what you want me to say? Is that true enough for you?
See, I'm kind of like, I don't think that's true, really. I don't see Hartnell as being the scared, leaving, cut off from his own people, he says at one point. I know he stole the TARDIS, but I think Patrick Troughton's explanation, he does say he was bored, but he gives an explanation for it. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to play the audio, and I'd love to get your guys' feedback, and I'd love to hear the feedback of the audience when it comes to this, because this is critical to this season.
Why did you run away from them in the first place? I was bored.
What do you mean you were bored?
The Time Lords are an immensely civilized race. We can control our own environment. We can live forever, barring accidents, and we have the secret of space-time travel.
Well, what's wrong in all that?
Well, we hardly ever use our great powers. We can sit simply to observe and gather knowledge.
And that wasn't enough for you?
No, of course not. With a whole galaxy to explore, millions of planets, eons of time, countless civilizations to meet.
Well, why do they object to you doing all that?
Well, it is a fact, Jamie, that I do tend to get involved with things.
Oh, you can say that again. Whenever there's any trouble, he's in it right up to his neck.
But you've helped people, Doctor.
Yes, that's no excuse in their eyes.
Well, then what are you
going to
do?
Oh, you're going to run away. I've set the controls to take us to a planet on the outermost fringes of the galaxy.
Oh, in that case, you'll probably end up right in their lap.
But see, that doesn't sound like a lie to me, right? Yeah. Am I wrong?
Oh, there's probably... None of us have just one reason for doing something. There are always multiple things, the things that we admit to ourselves and the things that we don't admit to ourselves. Mm-hmm. So some of this, I would say, is he was bored. Some of it is probably he was also scared of what he might become. Not necessarily scared of...
The hybrid,
because that clearly wasn't...
prophecy.
Yeah. None of that existed back in the 60s and 70s when they were writing. But at the same time, there's that... You know, why do we do what we do? And there's never going to be an answer. There are multiple elements to every answer. I think Troughton, for that particular doctor, that was very much the truth. That was the truth that he wanted to admit because he was bored. He was weary of non-interference.
Which is interesting, too, because in our first Hartnell episode, he has a journal where he's logging things, and he is more of that typical Time Lord who does not get involved.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just funny how he changes. Really, the time that he gets involved is when the caveman guy was trying to kill them and ended up getting almost killed, gored.
Mm-hmm.
And he was going to kill the caveman guy, and Ian and Barbara stop him and take the rock out of his hand.
Mm-hmm.
That was his involvement. He saw these people as brutes, and he saw himself to survive. He had to, you know, end this caveman's life who was trying to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
And Ian and Barbara stopped him. But I don't know. Maybe the history of it. Maybe there's some revisionist history going on in Moffat's world. Maybe I just don't know everything that Moffat is taking into consideration. I would love to know more. Your instant reaction, Rob, the Troughton clip?
I kind of think, like Peter was saying, that there are usually multiple reasons why we do something. We don't usually just do something for one reason. Maybe we're not aware of all of them at the time, but I think it's easier to see the Doctor as being bored and scared and that being his reason for leaving Gallifrey, because you could see that he says he's bored. Because we have all this ability to do all this traveling and keep ourselves alive forever and all these things, and we just sit there and we do nothing. So you can imagine that as a younger Gallifreyan boy, that he would sit there and be in the spirit of youth, saying like, "We can do all of this and we're not doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
What happens to my life if I just sit here and do nothing? I have all this power to change things, and I'm just sitting here." I mean, that's scary to a younger person. I sit there and think about myself with that. Yeah. That's why I go and say things on Facebook. They get people frustrated with me because I'm like, I sit there and I'm like, if nobody says this, what's going to happen?
I know, you're a pot
so,
stirrer.
So
you stir the pot, Rob.
Yeah, but so that's, and that's
let
who the
me,
doctor
let
is.
Let me stir with you. Mm-hmm. Let me stir with you because of this bootstrap paradox thing going on within this season as well.
Mm-hmm.
If this prophecy of a half Dalek, half Time Lord is true, mm-hmm. he kind of like waves it out of hand because he knows that the Daleks would never suffer a hybrid.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But that would also mean that he left Gallifrey originally to avoid this prophecy of a Dalek Time Lord hybrid mm-hmm. out of fear.
Mm-hmm.
Correct?
Well, again, is it? It was just two warrior races.
It's a legend, yes.
Yeah.
My question is then, as Hartnell, he doesn't know who the Daleks are.
Mm-hmm. That's the point that I made when we were going over the episode previously where we were talking about that, is that he runs into the Daleks.
Now, did it become the Daleks after, like in the legend, when he actually meets the Daleks and knows who they are? Is that the warrior race that he's saying? Or is it the Maiar? Or is it the Sontarans or the Cybermen or the Ice Warriors?
Or the humans?
Well, but you can even write this stuff off as being part of an overall bootstrap paradox for the whole series, too, though, for mm-hmm. as in all of Doctor Who. Is that you can say that the Daleks weren't on the Time Lord's minds until the Doctor ran into them
right.
and caused mm-hmm. all of this. And now, so all of a sudden,
so
because of
away.
The way that their timey-wimey stuff mm-hmm. works, once the Doctor did something to change it, now all of a sudden all of history is altered as well.
Caused because of it.
So now all of a sudden the mm-hmm. prophecy begins to exist in a time before when it didn't because he did yeah. this stuff.
Very now, I mean, Oedipus Rex.
To bring in the whole concept of the prophecy of the Dalek mixing with other things and this idea of the hybrid, think about the Dalek Asylum and how we start the Dalek Asylum.
Mm-hmm.
Is that they're Daleks that inhabit at least the dead physical body of other beings,
mm-hmm.
whether it's Earthlings or other alien races.
Mm-hmm.
But so how far away is that if a Dalek is using an inferior body as a hybrid? You know, because the Daleks have now already accepted using an inferior body to their own,
mm-hmm.
you know, so it wouldn't be that hard to imagine that the Daleks would then also keep some of the humanity. Think about into the Dalek. Think about like the way that Dalek was reacting to the Doctor.
Mm.
It wasn't pure Dalek, and which was part of why it was separate. But I don't think it's as hard to imagine that the Daleks would hybridize with something else. But I also just don't buy the hybrid thing. Period.
Because they did in the first place anyway. The Emperor Dalek I sifted
exactly
mm-hmm.
In the Christopher Eccleston story.
Mm-hmm. So there are other reasons why I'm really skeptical of the hybrid prophecy anyway. Not just the fact that it never existed until this year. But there's also been stuff. I mean, simply when you look at how we first met Clara,
mm-hmm.
you know, she was basically a hybrid Dalek because when that Dalek was there in chains in the asylum, it wasn't pure Dalek.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't even know it was a Dalek. So, right. I mean, granted, that was a failed Dalek, but
yeah.
still.
All the other Daleks were scared of that Dalek.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, maybe, and that's the thing that I've even thought about as time was going on. You know, you think about Clara and all the red and Clara being brought in and her being involved with the hybrid somehow and then all that. And then, like, I'm just like, why do we keep ignoring Clara as the Dalek being the whole beginning to her story? We keep mm-hmm. talking about the impossible girl, but then somehow in the story, Clara becomes a Dalek at some point. The Doctor has never made a point of that.
Well, I think that's part of the whole Splinter thing of saving him.
Right.
She will save him at every point that the Great Intelligence wants to
destroy.
So, right. But again, did she? I don't know. She was splintered off and injected into the little places, but she would have had to be splintered off at some time in the, you know, way before the storyline took place, to create that weird Clara Dalek,
mm-hmm.
like that weird Master Clara Dalek thing. And I don't know. I'm overanalyzing the whole arc of Doctor Who, but it's mm-hmm. just, yeah, like I said, I'm a nut for canon, and I'm a nut for, like, giant epic stories, and so when you, like, try to set something up as one producer, and then basically just say, well, that was a nice idea, but it didn't work, and you throw it away, and you write a whole new story to take its place, that frustrates me.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know.
Well, since we're talking about the hybrid, I have a couple of clips for that.
The hybrid. Long before the Time War, the Time Lords knew it was coming. Like a storm on the wind. There were many prophecies and stories. Legends before the fact. One of them was about a creature called the Hybrid. Half Dalek, half Time Lord. The ultimate warrior. But whose side would be on? Would it bring peace or destruction? Was it real or a fantasy? I confess, I know the Hybrid is real. I know where it is and what it is. I confess, I'm afraid.
Well, how he actually doesn't give any confession. He just,
yeah.
He gives no information whatsoever.
Well, I mean, that particular clip in the episode, doesn't that carry on? Isn't there a little bit more to that? Like,
no, but later on...
the door swings open and then he moves through it.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting is room 12, we're talking about the skin of this resetting rooms and stuff. Mm-hmm. Room 12 only opens after that last, like the third confession that he makes.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it took three confessions for him to gain entrance into that room. And that was the one room. Now, to me, I don't have a problem with the room not resetting. And the people are saying, oh, the diamond should have reset or the Asbantium should have reset. And maybe because it's a harder surface, that's why it didn't reset. It would be more difficult to reset.
A reset is a reset. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm just going to wipe that one away.
But to me, I didn't have a problem with that. I kind of have a problem with the technology and the castle not crumbling around him over 4.5 billion years. And mm-hmm. like the Meyer little device inside a Shielda, unless it was made out of something that could survive for eternity, mm-hmm. I would think that
nothing,
it would entropy.
Yeah.
Exactly. That
mm-hmm. everything finite has a beginning and an end. There is nothing infinite about a finite thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Except something abstract, like love. And
but even that's not a finite thing.
But you're making the point, though, that I was bringing up earlier about the bootstrap and how it doesn't... In my mind, a bootstrap only works when it's actually looping the same exact scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it's not, then it's not a loopback. It's not a bootstrap. Because if it changes, then it's not the same thing happening. You're not causing the same thing to take place.
Right.
So if it takes him... And that's where, again... The whole concept of the castle breaks when you say that what happens changes after he gives so many confessions.
Mm-hmm.
Because if he, like I said before, if he gets to the castle and he dies, he gets to the castle and he walks down that corridor, he opens the door and it's just a hard wall and the veil is coming at him, and he doesn't give a confession, he dies. But if he dies there, then none of the other things that he put in place for him to get to the point mm-hmm. where he dies at the wall and he climbs back up into the room to reset himself with the button at the machine, then he never repeated it.
Mm-hmm.
So he has to go through every one of those steps to get to the point where he's dragging himself bloodily up into the room to hit the reset button.
Mm-hmm.
And so it can't change. It can never be any different, because if it's different, then the butterfly effect again. If you change it, then somewhere in the process, something is different, and it will not repeat the same way.
Yeah,
and he's making sure that he's not regenerating too.
Right, but that's the point. Is that does he say that he's too damaged, or is that he stops it? Because that's the one thing I don't remember. Because there have been times where he says that when you are too hurt, it won't even work.
And I think that's what he was. I think
is it like
that's
just
what
the way that he got hurt
here.
By the veil
yeah.
that he couldn't
regenerate.
Even if he wanted
yep.
to.
Which is a nice out.
Well, that's the thing, though, right? That's a sonic screwdriver. Just say, like, oh, well, you just got too hurt to be able to regenerate. Because mm-hmm. otherwise, you could just regenerate while you're standing at the yeah. wall over and over and over again. You just keep punching the wall. I mean, think about it. He could just stand there punching the wall until
he
got so bloody and he's almost
case.
Dead. Mm-hmm. Or that, even. But that's...
Yeah, in a way, it would have been better if he himself didn't have to hit the reset button, but it just automatically reset. that would have solved so much of the issues.
And that's right, and that's kind of the point too, is that somehow the parts of the castle that reset, they reset on their own.
Mm-hmm.
But he has to reset himself by pressing the button. And then, as we said too, there are other things that don't seem to reset. If anything changes, then the whole thing changes, and it's not a loop back, so it can't change at all, because if it changed at all, then it wouldn't work. It's a stupid movie. But it exemplifies the point, though, is that as the kid, when the kid is younger, he goes into these blackout stages where he just blacks out. So then later on, as he grows up, he realizes that he blacked out when he was a kid because he had to go and loop back into his own timeline and change things. But the problem is that as he tried to change things from the way it happened to him originally, everything around him changes. The girl that he used to have a crush on, he wanted to change everything so that he could marry her and they would grow up together. One time he makes some kind of a little change that looks like it would have nothing to do with her, but then she ends up turning into like a prostitute in Las Vegas who's on coke. And he's like, he gets up frustrated, so he's like, well, I guess once I wake up I'm gonna have to try doing that again. So he has to go back and
this had a very Groundhog Day kind of.
Well, it's exactly what it is, because that's what it's about.
Although without the getting things exactly right.
Groundhog Day worked, again, because he had no control over the factors.
Right.
The only thing that he had was his experiences within that 24-hour period.
Mm-hmm.
And so he spent 10,000 years playing around,
right,
learning all the stuff that he wanted to, just because he wanted to have the fun.
But Run Lola Run is another movie that discusses the whole idea of loop back and repeating events and trying to alter them so that it works out for the better. Like I said, it's the frustration with this episode is I just keep trying to think about that stuff.
And who laid the breadcrumbs out?
Yeah.
Is basically the big question. Mm-hmm. And he realizes that he's done this forever at a certain point.
Mm-hmm. He realizes that it was him and that he's done it. Yeah.
Yeah. And once he's quote unquote killed, he says, get up off your ass and win. Sort of like a dream where you can die in a dream and then I'm not dead. You had to have a lucid dream. I'm not dead now. I'm gonna make sure that you pay.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of thing going on. And the TARDIS, his subconscious thinking spot, is neat. He protects the secret of the hybrid, and I think he protects the secret of the hybrid because he's protecting Clara.
Mm-hmm.
Because he is her carer. And he's making sure.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's telling as much as he can without giving it up. So he gets to the copy of himself, and he gets there and hooks himself up, and he's all bloody, and he just kind of like disappears after he his hard copy from the hard drive is
rebooted
up. So have 4.5 billion years actually passed? Or is that just within the confession dial?
Well, he's looking up at the sky and kind of evaluating the shift in the stars, as it were. And so, the first time...
Is he looking at the real stars?
That's a very good question, because how much of this is reality?
The stars aren't resetting either.
The stars aren't resetting.
He can feel time travel, he says.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So he knows he's not necessarily... time traveled, he's just, there's a long passage of time from point A to point B, and 7,000 years, a couple million years, a couple billion years, and then we find out in the next episode that it was 4.75 billion years, which isn't half the time of the universe, but we won't necessarily quibble too much on that.
Now, I've got another question based on this whole concept of it, the hard copy, is that... So where did the memories come from?
Yeah.
Are the memories in the ether? And then so he just happens
When he first teleported.
And so the memories from that teleportation are stored in the ether, so that when he reboots himself on a hard copy, the ether automatically uploads his memories to the point where he was when he first got there.
Yes.
That's the theory, anyway.
It's kind of like the transporter from Star Trek. It just... makes a complete and utter copy of you and then kills you and reassembles you elsewhere.
Yeah.
Well, they also use it in Revenge of the Cybermen, the Tom Baker episode. And Sarah has the cyber disease going through her arm and whatever, and they use the teleporter actually to mend her.
Mm-hmm.
Harry Sullivan has her in his arms, and she uses the teleporter so that it reconstitutes her without the disease.
Mm.
So he would be a perfect version of himself using the teleporter, I guess, I would assume. So he steps out, finally breaking free and avoiding another reboot of himself, another day and a half climbing upstairs. And as the sunlight hits the veil disintegrates. And so the final thing that we really see is a little boy coming up to him and him telling him that he's come the long way around. Go and find someone important.
Go and tell them.
Yeah. That I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
And tell them I came the long way around. Like, mm-hmm. I didn't confess anything, really. Three confessions, and they were minimal at that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he says the following.
So just between ourselves, you got the prophecy wrong. The hybrid is not half Dalek. Nothing is half Dalek. The Daleks would never allow that. The hybrid, destined to conquer Gallifrey and stand in its ruins.
So there we have it. And so it created quite an uproar on the interwebs.
Mm.
And then we have two other clips from the 1996 movie.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of discussion on the internet about his comment about being the hybrid, which was later laid to rest as the poppycock that it was.
Mm-hmm.
But here we go. So that was the infamous Eric Roberts playing the master, or the Terminator slash master.
Mm-hmm.
It's a highly controversial movie, of which has never truly quite been canonized, other than McGann as the Eighth Doctor. And he actually, there was an honorary Ninth Doctor as well, but we saw him later in Doctor Who, the Greater Intelligence.
Mm.
Half human on my mother's side.
A secret you must promise not to tell.
Oh, Professor Wag, this is Dr. Bowman. He's from London. He was just going to share a secret with us.
Professor, is there a chance of a closer look at the clock?
No, I'm afraid that I am the only person allowed up there.
Really, we can't just bend the rules and then.
No.
But you see,
Grace says that you have a big secret. What is it?
I'm half human on my mother's side.
Kind of sounded like a joke when he was telling it. So it's never actually been canonized. As far as I know, I think it was mentioned in Lungbarrow too, the prose, which I'm eager to find
there,
on TV. Well,
wasn't there also, weren't there statements about Susan, though, that she was not pure Time Lord? Not pure Gallifreyan, excuse me. Let me say it that way.
Well, there's a lot of interesting reasons why supposedly they left Gallifrey, and one of them wasn't that he was bored, although that's what he said as Patrick Troughton.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was that they were political exiles, and that Susan wasn't really his granddaughter, but more a political exile with him.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. No, you know where that comes from. That comes from the first take in The Unearthly Child. It comes from the first take where she mentions about the human side of them, which was taken out.
Mm.
And they actually, it was William Hartnell and Susan herself that created the whole "we're aliens cut off from our species" kind of thing going on.
Mm.
But hey.
And we could just decide not to keep looking that deeply into it, but, you know.
Well, I mean, there's been 50 years because they made the correct decision.
Yeah.
Because they made it not some little tinker in his backyard who created time travel like Jules Verne's time machine, or like the Peter Cushing movies, where it was completely different than an alien race.
Yep.
And so actually the War Games is the first one where we actually realize that the Doctor is from Gallifrey and that there's other Time Lords and and things. The whole structure, the whole mythology, the mythos. This is a unique episode. There's never been one where it was basically just a monologue of Peter Capaldi. And I've read online, try to keep abreast of all the memes and silliness going on. As someone is just like throwing BAFTAs and Oscars and things at him. Just give it to him now. Give it to him now. Because it was so brilliant the way he was able to keep the attention during 53 minutes of film of the audience in his acting. Just him alone, really. There's, I mean, bits of Clara, I guess, and bits of the Veil, but the Veil never speaks. And
neither does Clara.
Yeah, which is interesting, too, because he talks about how he was more telepathic younger when he opens the door with his mind, which I thought was funny.
Yeah.
There's a lot of little, because he's just talking to himself, a little one-liners.
Yeah, lots of little things that he's kind of thinking of and not really just speaking out loud. Things that he was probably thinking because he doesn't have anybody to talk to.
Soundboard. So, Peter, how many TARDISes?
As an actor, giving props to another actor for being able to keep your attention that well, I would say a 5. Some of the issues that I have with the story and the continuity drop this down to around a 4, maybe a little under a 4, 3.75 or something along those lines.
So overall?
Overall, yeah, it was definitely a very good, strong episode. So if you take the median, 4.25.
Okay. Robert?
I'd probably have to say the same kind of thing. I'd probably say about 4. Based on Peter Capaldi's job on this one, absolutely 5. Based on the flaws with the continuity of just the way that the loopback stuff worked, I'd probably have to give it like a 3. But for the attempt and just the way it went, it has to be bumped back up even because of that. So, you know, like 4, maybe 4.5 to kind of give him credit for trying something. That it was engaging, if nothing else. I mean, it wasn't like, okay, this is like boring, like he's walking around in corridors, like, you know, it wasn't one of those ones where you just kind of got tired of. Like, I think enough happened regularly to keep it enjoyable.
I believe this was directed by the same woman who did the end of last year too.
I think so.
Rachel Talele. Was Heaven's Where Danny Pink dies.
Death in Heaven.
Death in Heaven,
yeah. Thank you. It's been quite an interesting podcast. And the podcast before, we've done 2 in a row, and I'm a little burnt now.
heavy couple episodes with a lot of stuff to
go over, really. So, I need another coffee. This is a 5 for me. I think this is an instant classic, and I think it's going to be remembered like Moffat's Blink.
I can imagine.
And I think that this is one of those episodes that non-Doctor Who fans are going to watch and get into Doctor Who, which to me is huge, being a Doctor Who missionary. And I think it's an episode that I can point to and say, when someone asks, where do I start? Start at Heaven Sent. Usually I'll say start at any Doctor, their first episode, and just go with the entire Doctor. No matter who it is. Peter Davison, just watch his first episode and go. Tom Baker, watch his first episode and go. There's very rarely an episode that I can point to. Watch City of Death.
Right.
You know, watch Inferno. You know, when it comes to certain Doctors, I have my highlight ones. And I think Listen and Heaven Sent for me are definitely Peter Capaldi at his best.
I'm kind
of... Deep Breath is great, and now I finally remember the name of the episode. His first episode. I think regeneration episodes are good to start on for someone just to put their toe in the water. But overall, I think the atmosphere of it, the whole spookiness of it, it was very well filmed. It was gray slate, tan. And it was so singular. It was so encapsulating. Everything that the mist like quality to it, the gears, the movement of the castle. Trying to reason out. You're right there with Peter Capaldi because he has no other companion other than the viewer. you're right there trying to figure it out for him and with him.
And you almost get to be the... it's funny because it's almost like going back to Sleep No More in a sense, where you're just kind of like the sentient dust listening to what's going on.
This is nothing like Sleep No More. Take that back.
It's nothing like the story. I'll put it that way. But the fact that you're not like, you know, there is no interaction with you and Peter Capaldi. Not that we really do that, but the fact that he doesn't have anybody else to interact with, it leaves you in that kind of just...
It definitely reminds me of a dreamlike kind of quality and people's inner workings too, where there something's always going on in someone's brain, and all too often we don't get to be privy to that. I can't just, you know, I'd love to be a fly on someone's brain sometimes, and flies were in this episode. I like the TVs, the white noise, the way the TV projected what the veil was seeing, to add to the freakishness and the scare
of impending doom.
Yeah, of Peter, where he knew where the veil was, especially when he, I don't know exactly how long. People keep saying that one of these doctors was worth 1 week per death, and I don't know where they get that.
I got the idea that it was about a 5-day process that we were seeing.
So I didn't get any sense at all to that. I know he slept and he ate because he mentions that, but I didn't get really a sense of that. Like 4.5 billion years, and they're stretching it out to what, however many, 4.5 million lives, or 45 million lives. I'm not exactly sure. If that's the case, or if it was, how many hits would it take to get to the center of a Tootsie Roll Pop? You know?
Yeah. Well, it's just weird, too, when you think about, I don't know, the overall arching story they're playing about the Doctor, right, and just how important he is. Like, I just kind of think that it's weird when you think about the fact that the Doctor's dying. Every time that this happens, and it's not some catastrophic failure for the universe, for like time, you know. I think of the throw quote that I quoted the other day on Facebook, that, you know, you can't kill time without injuring eternity. And like, I think the Doctor, out of any character from any story that has to do with time, that the Doctor would be one of those things you can't kill without injuring eternity. And so it's just odd that 4.5 billion years can go on where the Doctor is doing nothing but dying over and over and over again. So,
well, I don't think it actually takes any time at all.
No, I agree.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of like...
because we see in the next episode that the Mistress of Karn is there.
Yep.
Right. And that's the thing that's weird. They tell Clara that for him it was 4.5 billion years. They don't say that it was actually 4.5 billion years worth of recorded history.
Yeah.
So
for me, a 5. So that's 2 5s in a row.
At the same time, for him, though, it was only a week.
Yeah, true.
Because he only remembers a week.
5 days or
however
whatever.
Long it is, exactly.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I used 5 days for my calculation.
Yeah. Officially?
That's my official, based off of the episode.
With the protractor?
No, but I was using my scientific
calculator.
We have a Hellbent and the Christmas episode coming up. It's not Christmas yet. We are 6 days from Christmas.
Don't tell me that. I still have script that I have to write for Christmas Eve.
6 days, Peter.
No, practice
that
is tomorrow.
That makes it 5 for him. Yes. Yeah, well,
I have a day.
Start punching that wall.
No, I don't have anything else.
No?
It was fun. It was quirky. It was annoying. It was Doctor Who.
Yeah,
it wasn't annoying. I didn't think anyway.
The discontinuities were.
Yeah, some of that was very Donnie Darko, where at least people are going to be discussing, in frustration, somewhat, but they're going to be it's going to create a dialogue.
Yeah,
yeah.
It does what it needs to do.
Right,
which is get people to talk about.
Moffat did a great job. 5 stars, Moffat, from me. 3
Yay,
and a half, or
Steve.
four and a half from,
Yay, Steve.
From Rob, and 4.25 from Petrie.
Yes.
Until next time.